As we record tonight, we're still kind of decompressing from Sunstone, and if you wickedly didn't go this year, say the requisite amount of Hail Elizar snows and so on, one of the most amazing parts of the symposium is you get to interact with so many different kinds of Mormons. Order Mormons, Christchurch Mormons, Active LDS Mormons, Never Mormons, Fire-Breathing Ex-Mormons, Mormons Behind Sheets. The flip side of this, however, is confronting the less pleasant parts of the Mormon spectrum. For example, while I was at the benchmark table, I overheard an older lady discussing a book with her husband. As her comment will shortly demonstrate, she was white. She pointed at friend of the podcast Paul Reeves' book, Religion of a Different Color, and smugly declared, "We were never that." Wrong. Well, mostly.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young, that only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
As we speak, the LDS Church is having yet another very public reckoning with its racial past. Proud BYU alumni can tell you that the administration building on campus is named the Abraham O. Smoot Building. And while it doesn't have an awesome nickname like the Swicket or Wilk or Marb, is that really a thing?
If you haven't seen the Marb's Twitter account, even as a proud Ute, I have to say someone there is doing their job.
I'm an Aggie, so I never had to know about these things. But still, anyone that knows anything about BYU knows that the Abraham O. Smoot Building is a key part of the university. Though his name might be less well known among the more righteous Utes or Aggie alumni, Smoot was a key figure in 19th century Mormonism. City alderman, mayor of Salt Lake City and Provo, 9-time missionary, bishop, stake president. You know what? You just get tired reading his list of positions. His son, Reed Smoot, would later be an apostle and senator, or apostolator. Just kidding, that's not a word, but it should be. So he would be both of those things simultaneously. It's not too surprising that a building at BYU was named after him. So what's the hubbub? Oh yeah, one more attribute of Smoot. He was a slave owner. Yeah, Abraham O. Smoot legally possessed other human beings. In Salt Lake Tribune's articles, Peggy Fletcher Stack's characteristically awesome article on the controversy, she notes, quote, "It troubles historian Paul Reeve to realize that any enslaved Mormon's best hope for freedom rested in the hands of U.S. Congress, not with fellow Latter-day Saints in Utah, which allowed slaveholders to keep the men and women they owned," end quote. Yeah, that's right. A lot of people don't realize that Mormons owned slaves. Utah was kind of a slave state, but things weren't always like this. Back in time we go.
As the temple and priesthood ban for people of African ancestry solidified into a policy by the time Brigham Young had succeeded Joseph Smith, another process was happening. Since the presence of early black Mormons, particularly during Joseph Smith's lifetime, greatly complicated that narrative, their history would often later be erased. We're going to try and restore some of their stories tonight. Think back to our last episode when strange things were afoot at the Circle K, K for Kirtland, of course. We mentioned a man known as Black Pete, who was later described as a revelator. Peter was not only one of the earliest Mormons of color, he was one of the earliest Mormons, period. Born in Pennsylvania about 1775, he seems to have moved to Kirtland in the 1820s. Peter was part of the family associated with Isaac Morley and likely joined the Mormon movement with him in late 1830 or early 1831. Peter was somewhat of an outlier since the majority of the new Mormons in the area were young, and Peter was around his mid-50s at that point.
Unfortunately, we don't have a ton of sources regarding his life and his Mormonism. Reports of him indicate he was a good singer, which is intriguing. We don't have much of a sense of what early Mormon hymns looked like. It seems mostly that they would have just continued to use familiar Protestant hymns since uniquely Mormon ones were waiting for people like Eliza R. Snow and W.W. Phelps to get their butts baptized and get to work. Two other fleeting hints at his impact. First, it appears that Peter drew on his background. His mother, Kino, was a slave and brought elements of that shout tradition into the Mormon worship. Second, we mentioned in an earlier episode that early Mormon religious practices in Kirtland included various charismatic practices. One of those was the concept of heavenly communications floating down from above. There was a story of Peter falling off a riverbank and crashing. Apparently, he was chasing one of those celestial letters. Vague references to him having some sort of authority can be found, but since Mormon priesthood was certainly not well defined yet, it's not clear what we can do with these hints. More ominously, there were rumors of miscegenation, possibly him expressing his interest in a daughter of Frederick G. Williams, which would not have been welcomed by his white co-religionists. In fact, miscegenation, the idea of a black person marrying a white person and having children, is a common running theme in Mormonism, which we'll talk about especially as we get into Brigham Young, who sort of had a problem with the whole thing. Anyway, black men to go after white women was seen as very dangerous. So whatever the case was, Peter disappears entirely from the scene as quickly as he entered it. We don't even know when or where he died. And I just want to point out that the story of like black men coming after white women, it didn't even really happen as much as people would accuse these men of. I mean, black men in America knew better than to approach white women or to get close, but that didn't stop a lot of accusations. And especially as we get into the Utah period, we'll see a lot of justifications for lynchings in Utah being black men looking or talking to or pursuing white women.
The story of Black Pete is one element of what historian Paul Reeve has termed the open racial vision of early Mormonism. Again, later generations would insist that the infamous temple and priesthood ban began with Joseph Smith, but it is clear that it did not. However, please don't misunderstand what we're saying here. There were not very many early black Mormons, and it's not like those that did join the movement had some sort of nice racism-free experience. By no means. Early Mormons were, by and large, from New England rather than the South. This does not, however, mean that they were free from common perspectives in society that assigned lesser intelligence to black people and saw skin color as some sort of nebulous mark for some equally hazy indiscretion that they committed who knows when.
The story of the next Black Mormon is one of the best examples of how Mormon theology drifted from the all are alike unto God to a hardline temple and priesthood ban.
Elijah Abel was born in Maryland in 1810. We don't know much about his childhood. However, it is possible that his parents were enslaved, but the evidence just isn't conclusive. By 1832, he is residing in Cincinnati and is later baptized by a missionary, Ezekiel Roberts. Over the next few years, he makes his way to Kirtland, where he is ordained an elder. His elder certificate was issued by Joseph Smith. Smith described him in this way: Elijah, a worthy brother in the Lord, one who is duly authorized to spread the gospel in a manner equal to the authority of that office, a man of good moral character and possessing a zeal for the cause of righteousness. This certificate is perhaps the single most definitive source that makes clear that the priesthood ban did not originate with Joseph Smith. The rest of 1836 was very eventful. He was washed and anointed in the Kirtland Temple, and then ordained by a 70, Zebedee Coltrane. Remember his name, that dirty liar. He served a mission in Canada, and he was also a member of the Kirtland Safety Society. In other words, Elijah Abel was a totally ordinary member of the church. Actually, let me take that back. He was a top-tier Mormon. A top-tier Mormon who was faithful to the end, and yet was still denied his saving ordinances by Brigham Young. A story we know all too well. The story of racial equality rolled back in the early church.
I want to say a special thanks to Dr. Misha McGriggs for doing the reading on Elijah Abel. Dr. McGriggs is a professional psychologist and works at the intersection of race and trauma, and she's a good friend of mine and has done a lot of podcast work on the history of Black Mormons. So thank you, Dr. McGriggs, for that. And I asked Darius Gray, who should need no introduction, but for those who don't know, Darius Gray is an important figure in modern Latter-day Saint history. He's an African-American Latter-day Saint speaker and writer who joined the LDS Church in the mid-1960s and was basically one of the people responsible for helping lift the priesthood ban. He directed a documentary with his co-producer, Margaret Blair Young, called Nobody Knows the Untold Story of Black Mormons. And he's been honored by the NAACP and all kinds of stuff. He's been all over the place. He's been on documentaries. He's amazing. He also helped develop the Race and the Priesthood essay, and he's been a longtime journalist. Anyway, I asked Darius, who is a dear friend of mine, if he would be willing to talk to us about Elijah Abel, but Darius is sort of on sabbatical from joining any projects. So instead, we're going to use his 2008 Sunstone audio that he gave at a Sunstone presentation where he talked about Elijah Abel as he talked about the screening for his movie, Nobody Knows the Untold Story of Black Mormons, which I definitely recommend you check out. Thank you, Darius.
Elijah Abel was ordained to the priesthood in 1836, and later that same year he was made a member of the 70. He served three full-time missions for the church, and he returned early from the third mission in 1884, ill, and subsequently died of exposure. He was indeed a priesthood holder, and from two sources that we have, historical sources, he was ordained by Joseph Smith Jr. himself. Yes, one of his sons also held a priesthood, but was not, to the best of my knowledge, ordained by his father. And a grandson, also named after the grandfather, Elijah Abel, the second or third generation, was ordained to the priesthood in 1934, and then was made an elder in 1935. So indeed, that family did have at least three of its members hold the priesthood prior to the 1978 revelation.
Over the next few years, Elijah Abel served three different missions to the East and Canada. His charisma while he was a missionary was apparently quite forceful. Decades later, Eunice Kinney reminisced of Abel, quote, "The Spirit rested upon him, and he preached a most powerful sermon. It was such a gospel sermon as I had never heard before, and I felt in my heart that he was one of God's chosen ministers." Close quote. After this mission, Elijah moved to Nauvoo, and then in 1843 returned to Cincinnati to catch a Reds game, but you know, also preach the gospel a little while he was there. The minutes of a branch conference sadly demonstrate the tension we've talked about. While Abel was a licensed elder, that didn't mean his race was not a sticking point. Apostle John E. Page heard Abel speak, and then noted that, quote, "He respects a colored brother as such, but wisdom forbids that we should introduce him before the public," close quote. Oof. Remember, scriptural mandates that God is no respecter of persons don't mean that his followers are ever paying attention. And sadly, Orson Pratt backed up his apostle colleague regarding Elijah Abel. While Paul Reeve and shorthand ninja LaJean Carruth have demonstrated that Orson Pratt would later push back against some of the racist rhetoric in Utah, at this point, Pratt swung and missed. Then, at this conference, the stark reality of being a black man was reinforced. Elijah Abel was instructed to, quote, "visit the colored population" in his missionary efforts. Abel was well aware of the score. He responded that, quote, he had no disposition to force himself upon an equality with white people, close quote. Again, when we talk about the few early black Mormons, even those like Elijah Abel who received priesthood, remember that this was the kind of environment in which they could use that priesthood.
Hey, Sunstone Podcast listeners. This is historian of Mormonism Christopher C. Smith back with you to talk about Black-ish Mormon Joseph T. Ball. Joseph T. Ball Sr. was a black man born in Jamaica. He arrived in Massachusetts in 1790 from Jamaica, and he married a white woman named Mary Drew. And the Balls were a very distinguished family. Joseph Sr. founded a society to care for black widows who were poor and impoverished. And then his four daughters, Lucy, Mary, Martha, and Hannah, all became activists for women's rights and for the abolition of slavery. And his son, Joseph T. Ball Jr., became a Mormon. And Joseph T. Ball Jr. is, of course, the one that we're interested in today. And Joseph T. Ball Jr. is a really significant figure for Mormon history because he's been cited as the first black person ordained as a high priest and also as the first black person to preside over a Mormon congregation. And until recently, his ordination seemed like really good evidence that black men were not banned from the LDS priesthood until after Joseph Smith's death, that Brigham Young had introduced the priesthood ban. But just a few months ago, a historian named Jeffrey Mahas published an article that completely transforms our understanding of Ball by showing that he had successfully passed as white. He had light skin, and his fellow Mormons saw him as white. There are no Mormon records that identify Ball as a black man. And unfortunately, this makes him less useful to Mormon theologians who want to challenge the priesthood ban, although there's still plenty of other evidence that the ban originated with Brigham Young, not with Joseph Smith, chief among them being Elijah Abel, another black man who was ordained to the priesthood during Joseph Smith's lifetime. So the case is not dependent on Ball. The fact that Ball passed as white also complicates his place in black Mormon history. So for instance, it's fair to ask whether he really belongs in a podcast episode about black Mormons if he was passing as white, because biological race doesn't exist. There's only the perception of race, the social construction of race. So if Ball was seen as white, then one could argue that for all intents and purposes, he was white. He didn't really get the black experience. I think, though, that the important thing is how he saw himself. He obviously knew about his black ancestry because his father was black. And he obviously knew that if people were aware of his ancestry, they'd have treated him differently. So yes, he had it better than a lot of other black people, but he still had to carry this secret around. And that's a burden, and it's a really important part of the black experience in America. The fact that light-skinned people of African ancestry have had to forget, erase, or lie about their ancestry in order to be recognized as human beings is part of the trauma of being a black American. So I think he's really important, actually, to include here. Now, Ball wasn't the only one in his family who passed as white. Interracial marriage was illegal in Massachusetts at the time that his parents got married, which may be why the parents, Joseph Ball Sr. and Mary Drew, lived together for 16 years and had six children out of wedlock before they got married in 1816. And by the time they got married, Joseph Ball Sr. may have been starting to pass as white. The 1810 and 1820 censuses list the Ball family as free colored persons. But from 1830 on, all the censuses list the whole family as white. And the daughters of the family also passed as white, even though they worked as anti-slavery activists on behalf of black people trying to abolish slavery. William Lloyd Garrison described the Ball sisters as white ladies. And one newspaper did note that Martha was slightly colored, but that just shows you how light-skinned she was. And then their Mormon brother, Joseph T. Ball Jr., is never described as black in Mormon records, and his fellow Mormons seem always to have seen him as white. Joseph T. Ball Jr. was born in Cambridge, Massachusetts on February 21st, 1804, and by 1832 he was living in Boston, and at that point a couple of Mormon missionaries come through and baptize him. It may have been Brigham and Joseph Young, or it may have been Orson Hyde and Samuel Smith. But whoever it was, he accepted Mormon baptism from them, and then he moved to Kirtland, Ohio in September 1833. And he apparently worked there as a cooper, which is a maker of barrels. And then sometime after March 1836, he was ordained an elder in the church. And in 1838, he served a mission to New England as the companion of Wilford Woodruff, a Mormon apostle. And he spent the next several years of his life in New York and New England as a traveling preacher. And then in just as one example of his success as a missionary, in October 1840, he baptized a whopping 50 people in Mansfield, Connecticut. So a really successful missionary. Then in 1841, he visited Nauvoo, Illinois, the church headquarters, where he performed some baptisms for the dead for his ancestors. And he received a mission call to South America that he never fulfilled. And he also received an elder's license. And by 1843, he was back to preaching, and he attended a conference in Cincinnati, Ohio. And at the conference, some apostles who were present told another black elder, Elijah Abel, that he was only allowed to preach to colored people, that it would be an embarrassment to the church to have a colored man representing the church as a missionary to white people. White people would find him offensive, and so he had to preach only to other colored people. And Ball at this conference received no such instruction, which just underscores how successfully he was passing as white at the time.
You look pretty righteous, so I'm not sure you're going to understand this simile, but most podcasts are like beer. You have to drink a lot to get that buzz. The Sunstone Magazine podcast, on the other hand, is like whiskey. Small glass, big buzz. That's because our podcast isn't about interviews, conversation, or witty banter. Rather, it presents audible quality recordings of Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry. Do you want to hear what the best LDS minds have to say when they say it perfectly? Then this podcast is for you. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone, and then join us for a weekly shot of the best of Mormon thought and experience. And yes, you'll be able to drive home safely afterward and get a temper recommend if you want.
2 years later, the Apostle William Smith, the brother of Joseph Smith, ordained Ball as a high priest and appointed him as president of the Boston branch of the church. And Ball served as branch president from October 1844 to March 1845. And this probably makes Ball the first person with black ancestry to serve as a high priest and a branch president, although William Smith obviously didn't know about Ball's ancestry at the time. And then in February 1845, Apostle Parley P. Pratt called Ball to go to Nauvoo to help build up the temple there. So Ball obeyed. He left for Nauvoo in March. En route, he presided over a regional conference of the church in Ohio, which gives you some idea that he was a pretty high-status person in the church to preside over a conference. And then soon after he arrived in Nauvoo in mid-July, William Smith gave him a patriarchal blessing that identified him as royal stock and as a member of the tribe of Joseph. And this is important because it underscores again that William saw him as white. Black members' patriarchal blessings in the 19th century always identified their lineage as Canaan, Ham, or Cain, rather than as Israelite. So this is an example of Ball being perceived as white. Unfortunately, the same month that Ball arrived in Nauvoo, some allegations of sexual misconduct caught up with him there. Now, it's important to put these in context. There had maybe been some hints of behavior problems with Ball before, but nothing definite. In 1836, his first application to be ordained as an elder was rejected for unknown reasons. But that was pretty common at the time, and it didn't necessarily imply any major sin on his part, so we shouldn't read too much into that. Obviously, he reapplied and was accepted as an elder within just a couple of years. And then in the winter of 1839 to 1840, when Ball served as a missionary in New York City, there were some complaints about his conduct there that were dropped. The complaints were dropped after they were investigated. So we don't know what those claims were. We don't know whether they were justified or not. But Ball never really got into serious trouble until he unfortunately got drawn into the sexcapades of Apostle William Smith. For several years at this point, William Smith had been a ringleader in what I can only describe as a sex ring. William was privately teaching people that it was religiously lawful for men to have sex with as many single women as they wanted, as long as the women kept it secret. William attributed this teaching to his brother Joseph, Joseph Smith, the prophet, and he drew quite a few prominent Mormon men into this practice, into this sex ring. And disciplinary hearings in 1842 named at least 9 Mormon men who solicited sex from Mormon women as part of this sex ring. Most of the men were disciplined in 1842, but Joseph Smith shielded William from prosecution and had his name struck from the disciplinary record, so William was free to continue this practice with impunity, which he did. And in 1844, on a mission to Boston with George J. Adams, William taught this sex doctrine to Samuel Brannan and also to Joseph Ball Jr., and these 4 men then began seducing women there in Boston. And members of the Boston branch reported this to Wilford Woodruff, Harley Pratt, and Orson Hyde, who reported it to Brigham Young. So there doesn't seem to have ever been any formal church disciplinary hearing, but the allegations contributed to a falling out between Brigham Young and William Smith that led William Smith to leave Nauvoo and to proclaim himself as Joseph Smith's rightful successor as prophet. And Joseph Ball Jr. follows William out of Nauvoo, becomes his religious follower for a couple years. And by 1848, Joseph Ball joins up with James Strang's church in Wisconsin. We don't know much about what happened to him after that, but by 1861, he died of tuberculosis. Now, Ball's involvement in William Smith's sex ring really complicates his legacy, obviously, and it's not the kind of thing that we really want to remember about the Black Mormon past. It doesn't make him look good. But it's important to keep in mind that he had been taught this by a Mormon apostle, the prophet's brother, that this was not sinful behavior, that God allowed this. And Ball also was only one of more than a dozen men involved in this practice. So that doesn't exonerate Ball from his conduct here, but it does put his behavior in a context, and it does suggest that he probably didn't see this as misconduct. He was acting in accordance with what he had been taught. I do want to end on a more positive note about Joseph Ball. While he was branch president in Boston, he wrote a Mormon hymn, and we have the text of this hymn, and I think it really shows the passion and sincerity of his religion. The first half of the hymn is a call to worship for the church. It's a calling for Christians to get up and shout praises to God. And the second half of the hymn is about how creation itself shouts praises to God by virtue of its majesty and beauty. And if you've ever studied about African-American Christianity in the 19th century, you may be familiar with what's called the ring shout tradition, the African-American shout tradition. This was a practice where Black Christians would dance in a circle, clapping or stomping, and they would sing these very beautiful, very distinctively Black worship songs, often pretty repetitive worship songs. So in light of this African-American shout tradition, I think it's really interesting that shouted praise is the whole theme of Ball's song. The first 5 stanzas of this song literally begin with the word shout. Is this Ball's African-American upbringing showing through? Maybe. And so in honor of that tradition and in recognition that this may be a kind of Black Mormon spiritual, I'd like to conclude by reading the entire text of this hymn. Before I do that, if you are a music producer or a musician who would like to be involved in producing some historical Mormon hymns, please contact me. You can catch me on Facebook. Again, my name is Christopher C. Smith. If you have trouble finding me on Facebook, you can go to my website at christophercarolsmith.com. Carol has 2 R's and 2 L's. And then in the follow me section down at the bottom, you will see a link to my Facebook. This is kind of a dream project of mine. I would love to put together some productions of Mormon hymns. You could be part of helping bring Joseph Ball's hymn and other early Mormon hymns to life. So here's the text of Joseph Ball's hymn. Shout aloud, O ye heralds, Christ makes you to sound. Salvation from Jesus to sinners around. Shout glory to Jesus and go in his name, and he by his Spirit will make you a flame. Shout aloud to your shepherd who give you his law. Your foes shall behold him and sink down in awe. Your Savior will give you his word for your sword, and with it you'll conquer, for Christ is the Lord. Shout aloud, O ye churches, for Jesus is King, and hold on rejoicing his praises to sing. Your tears shall be wiped, and soon you shall sing in eternal glory with Jesus your King. Shout aloud, for in Jesus your life shall increase. His promise is certain, and you shall have peace. depend on his mercy, and he'll carry you through, and you may shout glory while you're here below. Shout, Jesus is worthy, he's Zion's bright king. Ye young men and maidens, his praises now sing. O daughters of Zion, come sing your sweet song. Your harps have been hanging on willows too long. The birds sing his praises that fly in the air. The rose and the lily, his beauties declare. The fish in the ocean, he makes them to swim. They leap out of water in honor to him. The thunders, while roaring, is showing his voice. And showers descending make valleys rejoice. The mountains, in standing, do show forth his power. And waters are shouting from shore unto shore. The suns show his glory. The moon shows his praise. And stars, all in order, declare his decrees. The bow and the harvest do show he's the Lord, forever declaring the truth of his word. Here's glory and honor to Jesus below. All things here around us his power do show. He's worthy of honor from all things that be, on earth or in heaven and all in the sea. Salvation, dominion, with power and praise. Hallelujah to Jesus for riches of grace. Hosanna to Jesus, we'll shout and we'll sing, for he is our prophet, our priest, and our king.
If you're wondering why we haven't talked about any women yet, it's because these are the only Black Mormons we know of in the first decade of Mormonism. It doesn't mean that they weren't there, it's just the only ones that we have record of. So if anyone out there ever discovers anything, let us know. But we are going to certainly try to highlight the stories of the women, both people like Jane Manning James, as well as some of the lesser known Mormons from Boston. And eventually, when we get into the frontier period, we do know of a few women in the territory at the time. We will certainly talk about the rest of Elijah Abel's life. In fact, we'll do an entire episode discussing the history of the temple and priesthood ban. Jane and Elijah will play a huge part in how that story unfolds, including new documents.
All right, Books of Mormon report time. Today we're going to highlight the book from the top of the episode, Paul Reeves' Religion of a Different Color, Race and the Mormon Struggle for Whiteness, published by Oxford University Press. Drawing on the relatively new field of study that looks at whiteness and what it means, Paul looks at how Mormons were viewed in the 19th century and how they, in turn, projected that outward. Observers were making claims that Mormons, due to polygamy, constituted some sort of distinct race, and also they were going to become extinct because polygamy was making them sterile and deformed and weird. In response, Mormons essentially claimed, hey, no, Protestants, we're just like you, don't worry. We're not like Black people. See how we're consciously distancing ourselves from them? And so as part of this process, the temple and priesthood ban eventually solidifies into something that lasts. Paul is a great historian and an excellent writer, and honestly, this was one of the most interesting books I've read in probably the last decade of Mormon studies. Hold up, kids, because we're not done. Tonight, we have another feature, our Websites of Mormon report. You need to know about the Century of Black Mormons database because it is amazing. The site, which is hosted by my good old University of Utah, is trying to document all Black Mormons in the first 100 years of Mormonism. It's an ambitious project, but they've already got a good start, and it's going to be amazing when it's done. Their stories, along with awesome contemporary documents and photos, are brought to life, and it makes this very important part of Mormon history that much easier to research and appreciate.
As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.